this is Allison Sheridan of the NoCillaCast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Saturday, September 14th, 2014, and this is show number 501. You know, I was thinking about all the people saying another 500 episodes, and it occurred to me that, you know, when you have a few number of episodes, you get excited about, you know, 50 or 100 or 200. When you have 500, does that mean I don't get to celebrate until it's 1,000? Probably not. I mean, 600? What's 600? Anyway, we'll have 10 years coming up soon, so maybe we'll celebrate that. Well, Bart is going to be back on Chit Chat Across the Pond this week because we really wanted to finish what we started with the whole IP subnet thing last week. Two reasons I bring it up at the top of the show. First is that Bart regrets that when I asked in the middle of it, "You want to pause to gather your thoughts?" he declined that invitation. He regrets it because he feels his explanation got a bit tangly. He will be rectifying that by doing a quick run-through of what we learned last week to clarify things. Secondly, I want to tell you up front that while this was the heaviest, most difficult thing Bart has ever tried to explain to me, I stuck with it, and in the end, I did actually understand it. But you should have seen my face. Luckily, he couldn't. When he was in the middle of it, I'm just like, what are you even talking about during parts of it? I also want to give you motivation to stay with it, too. So I'm going to tell you what he told me near the end of the discussion. And that's the problem that all of this math will solve for you. Because he didn't really give us a motivation why we need to know this stuff. You'll hear me holler at him during the show that he should have told me that up front. Anyway, here's the scenario. You or someone you know has a network set up, and some of the devices seem to be able to do things that others can't. They can all talk to the internet, but one computer can, say, see a printer, and the other one can't. One can share to the Apple TV, but the other one can't. If you learn what Bart's teaching here and follow him through to teaching us how to use his cool new IP subnet calculator that he built, and even some of the logic that he teaches you, then you might be able to figure out what's wrong, or at the very least eliminate some possible culprits. That's a bit of a tease because there's way more to it than that, but hopefully you'll be motivated to buckle down and make it all the way through. Hey, if I can follow along, you can do it. Well, I'd like to kick off the show here by playing a review from first-time contributor Jeffrey from New Hampshire on an app called iFlix for OS X. I've been torturing Jeff for weeks by pushing the review out week after week. I keep saying, oh, I promise it'll be on next week. But I'm glad I finally made room for it in this week's show. In the middle of the review, you're going to be hearing someone talking. I was confused at first until I realized that Jeff was using the VoiceOver screen reader on the Mac as he's blind. It's actually a great representation of how VoiceOver works and how quickly people like Jeff listen to the voice speaking the menus. The review of the applications, of course, fantastic too, but I just want to let you know what that was so you don't get confused like I was. Okay, enough preamble. Let's hear Jeff's review.
Hi, Miss Allison and Miss Little Castaways. This is Jeff from New Hampshire, and here's my review of iFlix. So the problem to be solved is, if you download movies or TV shows from another source besides the iTunes store, they get put into iTunes as home videos, and they have no descriptions. Well, iFlix, which is available in the Mac App Store, comes to the rescue. First, before you start, if you're doing like a series, season of TV shows,
Finder,
you should have it set up so it's like the name of the show, and then season one is a folded title. And then the shows, each episode is 01, 02, 03. Otherwise, if there's extra information in there, iFlix gets confused.
iFlix.
So here we go with iFlix.
iFlix. Toolbar. Downloads.
At the top, there's a toolbar.
iTunes compatible.
And the first one's preset, which I have iTunes compatible.
Downloads. Destination.
And destination is the second one, which I have downloads.
Stop. Image browser. Empty.
And that tells you the title once you get it imported.
Remove. Did uncheck. Add. Uncheck. Check. In movies.
So we're going to add files
cover
now.
Array. Movies. Search tech. Movies. Menu. Jeffrey Green. Connect. Check. Vertical. Browser. Interact. Application. Desk. Doc. Downloads. Cheers. Season 1. 0001.
So we're doing Cheers Season 1.
22 items selected. Stop. Interact. Open. Open. Add. Image browser. List 1 item selected. Cheers. Image.
Now under the image browser, it says Cheers because it recognized what these are. And it'll put in all the metadata with each episode information.
Start button.
So I'm going to hit start.
Press Q window.
And the
clear
Q window
button
comes up. And now I'm going to pause the recording while they're processing, and then I'll pick it back up. Okay, iFlix is done. I'm in iTunes. I just imported season one into iTunes, and it came in under TV shows. And here we see, we'll get a description with each episode.
Two, Sam's Women. Cheers. Diane sees him about his airhead women sends Sam looking for a date of a higher cerebral plane, and an old customer insists he must see the former owner to discuss his personal problems. 2 5 minutes. More collapsed disclosure triangle.
Okay, I don't know if you can understand that. The voice might be too fast, but it works. And the best thing of all is it's voiceover compatible. One note is if you search for iFlix in the App Store, you'll find two items. One called iFlix and one called iFlix 2. And iFlix 2 is $24.95, and I have both. The only difference I can see is iFlix 2 offers more conversion options, and it doesn't require a system paying download to run. But iFlix 2 is flaky. Like, if I do a whole season of TV shows, about every third show is not playable. I don't know why. So the original iFlix is the one to get, and it works well. And I hope you like this review.
Hey, thanks, Jeffrey. That was fantastic. I got to say, this is exactly the problem that Honda Bob wrote to me about one time. It was driving him crazy that he would create rip movies, and when he brought them in, they were always called home movies. And he asked me a long time ago what the solution was. Now, there's one trick here. Honda Bob is considering getting a Macintosh. Maybe this will push him over the edge, because he's always been a Windows user, and he's always asking me for help, but I don't know how to help him. So I really hope he'll be able to switch to the Mac, and then he can use iFlix. Thanks a lot, Jeffrey. Hope you do some more reviews. So, hooked up to our TV, we've got a TiVo, a Mac Mini, an Apple TV, a Roku, and a Chromecast. But when Donald Burr tipped me off that the Fire TV Stick was coming out, and for 2 days, Prime members could get it for $20, normally $39, I immediately had Steve check to see if we had any open HDMI ports left on a receiver. Luckily, we got a new receiver recently that has 8 ports, so I think we had, you know, 1 or 2 left. In the search for the holy grail of TV watching, we added the Fire TV Stick to our arsenal when it arrived. Now, what problem do I hope to have the Fire TV Stick solve for us? Well, we already get Netflix on every device we own. I mean, I'm pretty sure our toaster gets it. We get Amazon Video on the Roku, and that works really, really well. We haven't done the Plex thing yet to play our movies, but a few of our devices will do that when I get around to it. The Apple TV is great for renting movies and watching the keynotes, and we use AirPlay every single day to fling video podcasts to the TV, but I hate that little remote with a passion, and the Apple TV doesn't get Amazon. I love the remote for the Roku. It fits so nicely in my hand, and it's much easier to turn on subtitles than it is on the Apple TV. Unfortunately, it shows me what I've watched on Netflix in the reverse order of the Apple TV, so I get kind of confused because we switch back and forth between the two. I don't do much but Netflix and Amazon with it, but the experience is good with the Roku. The Chromecast is more of a novelty item. When I do launch it, I get confused looking for the remote until I remember there is no remote for the Chromecast. For us, it's a lot like AirPlay, but harder to figure out, so we don't use the Chromecast very often. When the Fire TV arrived, it was very nicely packaged. It comes with a remote that looks about halfway between the size of an Apple TV and a Roku. Not as comfortable as a Roku, but way better than the Apple TV. Has the same ring for forward and back and select as the Apple TV, a back button, home button, play, fast forward, and back buttons. Fast forward and fast back buttons. It also has a 6th button that looks like the hamburger icon in iOS apps, you know, the 3 little horizontal lines. Well, for extra money, you can buy the fancy remote for the Fire TV Stick that lets you use the voice control to search. Or there's an Android app that'll allow you to do it, and they claim iOS app coming soon that will let you do the voice search. I wasn't interested in spending extra money for that voice control remote, especially since it only searches within the Amazon app, nothing else. A lot of people won't tell you that. They think that the search goes across everything that you've got on it, like Netflix. No, it only shows you what's on the Amazon app. The stick is about the length of my fingers and about 1 inch wide. We were immediately worried it would be too wide to jam into the HDMI ports because it would hit the connectors on either side. Luckily, Amazon includes an HDMI extender cable that makes it fit in perfectly. It also comes with a very nicely packaged power plug and a good long USB cable. That means the Fire TV Stick, like the Chromecast, requires power, which is a bummer. Speaking of power, they even included 2 AA batteries for the remote. The USB power cable sticks out of the side of the Fire TV stick, which at first struck me as a bit odd because it makes kind of a clunky-looking pile of stuff when you get it all put together. But then I realized that the limiting space factor for many units is the space behind a device, so if the power comes out the side instead of the back, that could be an advantage. It's a funny-looking little mess when you got all the pieces put together, though. When we plugged it in, and after fighting with the receiver remote to try and figure out which input we'd selected, you know, you sit there going, which one of these is it, and flipping through until you figure out which one lights up the TV. Anyway, once we were done fighting with the receiver, we were greeted with an on-screen guide to set up Wi-Fi. I expected typing to be as annoying with the ring on the Fire TV stick remote as it is on the TiVo and Apple TV and Roku, but it had one rather nice tiny little feature. In general, it was as annoying, but you know how you can't go flying across the virtual keyboard, like just hold it down, because it'll actually go past the keyboard and highlight something else like done on the right or the back or the left? With the Fire TV stick, it stops at the end of the row of letters. I know it's small, but it made me really happy. Anyway, it next got to a screen that said connecting to the network for a little bit. Then it decided to check for updates, which gave me time to go pour another refreshing beverage. After that, though, it asked me if I wanted to continue as Allison Sheridan. Ever since my first Kindle reader purchase, it's always freaked me out when Amazon does that. Somehow they've connected my purchase order to the device itself. It's kind of freaky. On the other hand, it's super convenient because I didn't have to enter any passwords with that annoying little remote. On the third hand, if you buy a Fire TV stick as a gift or any Amazon Direct product like this, you might want to check into how to not have the receiver have access to your account. I wonder if their system is clever enough to recognize if you've tapped the box that says, "This is a gift." Anyway, next in the interface comes up a nice little cartoon man. He gave us a brief introduction to the Fire TV stick. I know it's dumb, and I know it's cheesy, but it did actually make me feel more comfortable with the interface. He even showed us how to push the home and back buttons on the remote. He told us about what channels we could watch, and get this, he said it comes with Netflix before he said it comes with Amazon Prime Videos. He even said shows like House of Cards on Netflix. Like I said, it was a nice little introduction. The interface on the Fire TV stick is very clean. It's a dark theme with a list of things you can go through on the left. You have home, Prime Video, movies, TVs, apps, or TV apps, games, that kind of thing on the left. The selected item is bright yellow while everything else is a very muted gray. To the right, you get nice big thumbnails of the shows and channels. Here's what I noticed the most about the interface. It got out of our way. Very quickly, we thought, hey, there's Orphan Black. We need to watch another episode. We fast-forwarded easily. We were able to back up 10 seconds with one button click. We went forward easily. We even found subtitles quite easily. Now, remember that little hamburger button? That brings up the options like subtitles and to jump to the next episode, which we also used. When we were done watching Orphan Black, which is an amazing show, by the way, we saw Outer Limits and remembered, hey, we still have a lot of those left to watch, and we moved on. We watched three shows and then suddenly remembered we were testing a new device. We had no confusion with how to use the Fire TV stick, and it worked really, really well. Now, this is a first look, so the proof will be which remote we reach for in the future when we want to watch some non-Apple-specific content. But I have to say, for day one, the Fire TV stick from Amazon was awesome.
Hey there, Allison. Donald from Otakumo Podcast, here with a review of the Epson LabelWorks LW600P app-enabled portable label printer. Of course, we start with a problem to be solved. This one may seem pretty obvious. To get organized. Okay, I guess maybe I need to be a little more specific. If you're like me, you've got a ton of gadgets. You know, camera stuff, video stuff, computer stuff, little handheld things. And each of these probably comes with some sort of charger or another. The problem is that a lot of them have very similar looking plugs, but very different voltages, and they don't mix and match very well. So why not label which cords go with which devices? Or let's say that you have a desk full of different cables of different types, big rat's nest mess, and you want to get that somewhat organized. So you get one of those little plastic file drawer thingies, but you want to label the drawers so that you can tell which kind of cable is where, don't you? Or maybe you have a lot of paper files. Yes, believe it or not, some of us still have to keep paper files. So you'd want to put the various documents of various types into file folders and label what they are, right? The solution to all of the above is a label printer. The problem, though, is they really suck. They have these lousy little rubbery keyboards. They have these little tiny LCD displays, and they're not very versatile. Enter the Epson LabelWorks app-enabled label printer. This is a little device, about 6 by 5 by 2 inches. It has a large door on the side of the machine where you load in the label tape cartridges. It has a window on both the side of the device as well as the front of the device that lets you see what type of labels that you have loaded, pretty handy. And on the rear, there are connections for both power and USB. But looking at this device, you'll notice something that's conspicuously absent. There's no keyboard and no display. That's because this device is app-enabled. You can design and print your labels using a PC or Mac, as well as an iOS or Android device. With this device, you can print on various types of labels anywhere from a quarter inch to 1 inch wide. You can print over USB from a Windows machine or a Mac. And finally, you can print from iOS and Android devices over Bluetooth. Yes, this printer actually has Bluetooth built in. Pretty cool. Using the app, you can print both text, graphics, as well as various formats of barcodes. You can also mix text and graphics and barcodes. You have a wide variety of text styles, single line, multi-line, variable font and font sizes, and you can even add borders and such. The pros of this device are that it has a wide variety of label types that you can print on. Standard stick-on labels, extra strong adhesive labels, cable wrap labels, even iron-on transfer labels. There's also different colors of labels, including clear. The printer knows what kind of label cartridge is installed. That way, you can't accidentally print a design that requires a wider label on a narrow one. The printer can be powered either by AC adapter, which is included, or via batteries, 6 AA batteries to be precise. The app also comes with a lot of standard template labels. The app lets you customize a whole bunch of things about your labels. You can use images either from their built-in clip art library or from your own photo library. And finally, this thing has excellent build quality. It feels very solid and well-built. There are a few cons, however. The cartridges cannot be hot-swapped. Kind of a pain. The app, while pretty good, can get a bit wonky at times. First of all, it's not iPhone 6 or 6 Plus optimized. The app also sometimes gets into a mode where, like, all the menu choices disappears, and it just acts really strange and bizarre. The app also very occasionally doesn't detect the printer when it's connected. In all cases, I was able to get the app to behave itself again by force quitting and relaunching it. And finally, the UI is a bit clunky and strangely organized, but this is a bit of a minor gripe because otherwise the app works pretty good. And I'm sure they'll address most, if not all, of the little glitches in future updates to the app. Finally, there's the price of the unit, $100, which may seem a bit steep, but when you compare it to professional office-grade label printers, which usually run $50 to $70 or so, the price is reasonable, given the extra features and the versatility of this device. The label cartridges themselves are also seem a bit on the pricey side, about $25 a pop, but they do last a really long time. This is a great, solidly built, and versatile unit that makes creating really nice-looking labels a snap. The app, while a bit wonky sometimes, still works reasonably well. Now, I mentioned a few use cases at the beginning of this review, but when you think about it, there are quite a few more. You can print pretty nice-looking luggage tags. You can print labels to stick to your devices, you know, that say, if found, please return to, you know, so-and-so. If you're trying to put together a conference or a seminar on the cheap, you can use this to print pretty good-looking name badges. You know, just print a person's name and contact information, stick it to a piece of cardboard, stick it in a badge holder, and you're good to go. If you own a small retail store, now you can print barcodes for all your products. That way, you know, people can scan them at your, you know, Square cash register and boom, instant checkout system. And of course, you can print QR codes to advertise your band or your club or, you know, what your podcast or whatever it is you're trying to advertise and stick it to all of your promotional materials. Really, the sky's the limit when it comes to use cases for this printer. Check it out at the link that Allison will put in the show notes. And finally, be sure and check out otakunopodcast.com if you're at all curious about Japanese animation, anime, comics, manga, culture, food, travel, and so on. Hope you enjoyed the review, and I'll see you next time.
Hey, thanks, Donald. This thing looks really cool. Steve and I love labeling things. I think we got it from his father. He labels absolutely everything. I took a look at the label costs on the Epson, and it turns out they aren't always as high as you said. The 1-inch tape is listed at $24, but the 3/4-inch tape is only $14. Then again, if you want those fancy cable wrap tapes, they're going to set you back $28. So you do have to make sure you're getting the tape that you need for the price that you're willing to pay. Donald mentioned that the tapes last forever, so I looked at the specs, and it turns out these tapes are 30 feet long. Let's say you use 2 inches of tape, which is a lot for a single label. That would be 180 labels you could get out of one cartridge. You'd have one on the, you know, on the cat by then if you had to make that many labels. I wanted to point that out in case the idea of this sounded cool to someone, but they were put off by the high price of the tapes. And it does come with a tape, by the way. I also asked Donald to elaborate on what did you mean when you said the tapes aren't hot swappable. He just means you have to power the unit down to pull out the tapes. Now, the reason that's more of a pain than it sounds is that you lose Bluetooth connectivity when you power it down, and we know how janky Bluetooth is. Anyway, Donald, I think this sounds like a very cool tool. Well, hey, I'm going to make a plea to you guys right now. The holidays are going to get a little bit tricky. I got to check the dates here, but it seems to me that Christmas is on a Thursday, but I'm going out of town on the 23rd, won't be back till the 28th. It's going to be really, really tricky for me to get the show done on the 28th. I will get the show done. It's going to be really, really close. In fact, live show might be in danger on that day. But anyway, I will get it done. But if you guys have reviews that you'd like to send in, I would really, really like it. I was really tempted to save these user reviews from this week, again, till the holidays. But I figured the three guys would kill me if I did that. So I didn't. So I went ahead and played them. But if you have reviews that you've been meaning to do, I would love it if you send them in really soon. This coming week's going to be a little bit tight. But the week after, it's going to be really tight. So if we don't want like a 6-minute show, it would be awesome if you guys could help me out. So send in your reviews, and let's see, I'm going to tell everyone that Kirsten said she's going to do one, so send them in if you can. Well, since we're interrupting the show here anyway with random things, remember I mentioned a while ago to use the Amazon affiliate link for your holiday shopping? That is a big way that the show gets funded. So if you can remember to go to podfeet.com, just use the little search box on podfeet.com on the Amazon link. If you don't see the Amazon logo, by the way, that means you've got flash block or ad block turned on. So turn that off for a second, go there, click on the button, then you can turn it back on again when you're done. But anyway, if you do go to that link and do your search from there, everything you buy will send a very small percentage back to the show. So, customer service announcement there ended. Well, remember last week I promised that I'd get my domains transferred over to our newest sponsor, Hover? Well, I'm going to have to welch on that promise, but it's actually an even better story of why to register your domains with Hover. Let me back up a little bit and explain what a domain actually is to the uninitiated. Whenever you create a website, you have to have several pieces put in place. The most important piece is to buy a hosting plan from someone so that your files actually live on a server somewhere on the internet. Your content, right, that shows on screen. There's about a gazillion hosting companies out there, and many are quite good. So now you've got your website up there on a server, but how do people get to it? Well, they get to it by typing in your domain name, like podfeet.com. In order to use a name like podfeet.com, you have to rent it from a domain registrar, and there aren't that many of those. I say rent, by the way, because if you don't pay your yearly fee, or you can pay multiple years in advance, someone else can start renting it and you lose the name. Okay, so I have my domain, podfeet.com, with these other guys, but I want to move it over to Hover, and I promised you I would get it done by today. Well, with the other guys, they charge you extra to have your home address be private. And let that sink in a little bit. If you don't pay them extra money, your home address is on the internet associated with your account. If you've ever flown in Europe, it's like when you book a flight on Ryanair for something like $12, but then they charge you extra because they say, oh, you wanted a seat and oxygen and to get off the plane later? Oh, yeah, those are extra charges. This hiding of your personal information is called domain privacy. In order to move my domain from the other guys to Hover, I have to temporarily turn off domain privacy. But guess what? The other guys farmed this service out to a third party called Domains by Proxy. Okay, fine. How do I get into Domains by Proxy? Well, according to my current domain company, they sent me the login information to get in Domains by Proxy on November 4th, 2006. Now, I actually do have my email on one of my accounts back to November 4th, 2006, and I checked it, and I have a nice email from New York Linda, who's in the chat room right now, and I think one from my daughter, but I do not have any email from this other company giving me my Domains by Proxy account. So I tell the other company, okay, reset my account. Nope, we can't do that. You have to talk to Domains by Proxy. But guess what? I can't get into Domains by Proxy because I don't even know my account number, and these people won't give it to me. They say they don't have it. I don't know what email account I was using 8 years ago, other than the only one I do still have. So, of course, you know, it can't be AllisonPodfeet.com the way you normally write to me because I didn't have Podfeet.com yet, so I couldn't have been using AllisonPodfeet.com. I only know one other address I've ever used that I can remember. Anyway, the other guys told me that the only way I could get into my login account or get my login account changed to a current email address was to email a copy of my driver's license or passport to Domains by Proxy. This is a company I've never heard of before, right? And I'm going to send them my personally identifiable information. They also told me it would take 24 hours for these guys to get back to me. Well, it's been more than 24 hours and I'm still waiting and I'm still checking my spam filter. The good news is that my new little friend Mark from Hover called me because I had whined in an email to them about this malarkey, and he was very sympathetic and told me in no uncertain terms that when I finally escape the clutches of my previous domain name provider, Hover will not have a third party manage my domain privacy. They handle it in-house. So do you see why choosing the right domain hosting company is critical to your sanity? Stay tuned. I'm sure by next week I'll be happy and cozy over at Hover. If the other guys let me go, that is. In the meantime, while you wait for the end of my saga, head on over to hover.com and use the coupon code PODFEET12 or just click on the big Hover logo in the right sidebar to get 10% off of your domain hosting.
George from Tulsa here to give you a brief overview of three Android devices I recently purchased. The NVIDIA Shield tablet is a serious gaming machine and showpiece for NVIDIA's connected gaming network. It's also the fastest Android tablet on the market today, surpassing even Google's flagship Nexus 9. I'm not a gamer. Think Atari 2600. And bought the 32GB LTE Shield to connect my camera card, copy off Olympus format RAW files, and edit them using the Android app PhotoMate R2. I hadn't even installed Portal in the Half-Life series NVIDIA promoted as draws to buy the Shield. But on Thanksgiving Day, my visiting younger generation saw the Shield and begged, then disappeared into gameland. The Shield's form factor is much like the familiar Nexus 7, just a bit bigger. It offers a 1920 by 1200 screen, dual front-facing stereo speakers, and even a subwoofer. Leave your Bluetooth at home. There's a stylus and apps that use it. My daughter, the art school graduate, reports the stylus works pretty well, but isn't a threat to replace her Wacom Cintiq Android tablet. I upgraded my Shield to Android 5 Lollipop before setting it up. After using Android L on that device, I blocked its install on my Nexus 5 phone and 7 tablet. Maybe someday, not yet. It is too bright, I'm not a fan of card-based notifications throughout, and prefer the ease of accessing settings on the older KitKat. KitKat is faster. The Shield came unlocked with an AT&T SIM. I had no trouble activating it on T-Mobile as a 3GB, $10 a month add to our existing plan. Lisa at Mobile Tech Review did her usual thorough review of the Shield when it first released. If anything I've said about the Shield captures your interest, refer to Allison's show notes for a link to Lisa's review. Amazon's Fire HD 6 tablet is cheap, really cheap, priced as low as $99. It's also quite good, if a bit heavy. I bought one because I've been carrying last year's far more powerful HDX7 in a pouch while I walk, so I can listen as Amazon's superb text-to-speech reads Kindle eBooks. The HD6 is running Fire OS 4.5.1, a much improved version of Amazon's Android fork. Its physical controls are easier to operate by touch than the more expensive HDX. Overall, an amazing device for the price point. After I bought the HD6, I thought how much better it would be if smaller and lighter, like, say, phone-sized. And no sooner did I make that wish than Amazon delivered, putting the 32GB Fire Phone LTE unlocked GSM on sale for $199 and throwing in a year of Prime worth $100. It's no wonder the Fire Phone was a giant fail. Its UI isn't good, depending on 4 battery-sucking cameras to track a user's face and present context-sensitive menus. The Fire Phone is hot to the touch in default mode and munched its battery fast. I turned all that stuff that Amazon calls dynamic perspective off, which saves much processing and battery, but leaves holes in the UI. I had to use the built-in Mayday help feature to find audiobook menus that stopped appearing without the tilt response that's part of dynamic perspective. It's just too bad. The Fire Phone, minus the bizarre dynamic perspective cameras and UI, is a solid device with good performance. The camera is 13 megapixels with optical stabilization and f2 lens. Its side-firing stereo speakers have good separation, work okay in a quiet room, are best for straight voice, but won't inspire owners to leave the Bluetooth behind. To wrap up, if you're interested in serious and mobile gaming, the Shield currently has no real competition. If you're open to Android and want Android best performance, it's the Shield. At the current unlocked price of $449, though that does include the year of Prime, I don't see how Amazon will sell any of its Fire Phones that are stuffed into warehouses. I know this may not be fair, but I just can't see relying on that device as a communication tool. There are better tablets than the Fire 6, but there's simply nothing else for sale today that's competent, pleasant to use, so portable, and offers so much entertainment value for so little money. Get the 16GB version. Consider Amazon's all-you-want $9.99 a month Kindle Unlimited with tens of thousands of books and audiobooks, and with the addition of Amazon Prime, music streaming, and cloud storage. If any Amazon-branded gear interests you, watch for daily deals. Seems there's always something on fire sale this holiday season.
All right, George, nice pun. So glad to hear from you again. Steve was pointing out in the live chat that we haven't heard a review from you in a long time. And I also appreciate you doing the review twice. George had done it, but since I delayed it, actually wrecked some of the pricing and stuff he was talking about. So very nice that you did it twice. Great show notes, great links. Everything's fantastic. Really appreciate you doing that, George. Looks like some pretty cool stuff out there. I love how many choices we have. Remember last week when Barry invited all of us to come to a barbecue at his house this coming summer in Chicago? I talked him offline, and he's actually serious about this. I suggested that in addition to his website for the event, he should have a registration form. I offered to help him create it using Google Forms. He sounded interested and was happy to have the help. Then I realized I shouldn't just fish for him. I should teach the man to fish. How do you think I did that? Well, of course, I flipped open my trusty Clarify. I took screenshots as I created the forms for him, and it was only a matter of adding a little bit of text here and there, some outlining boxes, and a few arrows. I had a tutorial for him that I knew he could follow. I probably spent 10 minutes making sure I'd have the good screenshots and adding all the annotations so that I'd have the nice document for him that I could send on to him. If you want to help others and make them stop badgering you with questions when they forget what you told them, go over to clarify-it.com and check out the free trial of Clarify. You can buy it there, or you can get it from the Mac App Store if you'd prefer. Stay tuned here for more information on Barry's Mac Barbecue. Hope to see you in Chicago, even if you do have a 3-month-old baby at that time. And Kevin, I don't want to hear any whining about being on Father's Day. It's Father's Day. That's what you should get to do, is come to Barry's Barbecue. it's that time of the week again. It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond. And Bart Bouchatz has agreed to come back and pick up where we left off in Taming the Terminal Part 25 of NIP Subnets, because we didn't want to let much time go between these two segments because they were supposed to be one segment, but it was running long. So maybe it made it one or made it two. So anyway, Bart, you're back.
Hello. And it's not so much continuing as I think we're going to go back to the start. There was a great moment there where you actually said, do you want to pause for a minute? And I went, no.
Gather your thoughts.
Yeah, and I should have gone, yes.
I think it's unusual for you to have ever lost your way, so you didn't recognize it, because it's probably the first time I've ever heard you just stop. And when you stopped, I was like, okay, maybe he needs to figure out where he's going.
Yeah, no, basically the problem was I tried to do too much in one weekend last weekend. Having run after steam trains all weekend, I then went and tried to write and record this, and my brain obviously wasn't up to it. Because I'd managed to write my mistake into my show notes.
Oh.
So I derailed myself.
Well, that's good. Well, I could use a refresher on what we went over last week. So we're going to go quicker, right? And
yes.
Then pick up where we left off.
Exactly. And this time it'll have more of a beginning, middle, and end. It'll flow nicer.
And you also told me before we got started recording that you've actually rewritten some of the show notes because they were not perfectly clear, and you wanted to pick
yes.
up where we left off for that too.
Exactly. So the same link, it's still at the same URL, but it's been actually, you know, like it's only about a 5% change, but some stuff was moved around a bit and some stuff was clarified. So it's an important 5%.
Good. I like it when things are clarified. Sorry, Doug started it.
I can't think of that word without a capital C.
I like it. It's like Kleenex now, huh?
Yes, exactly. Only Kleenex wasn't a word before they made the Kleenex. Clarify was a word, and now it's been
hijacked.
Anyway.
Alrighty.
Okay, so to set the picture, in the previous installments, we were looking at the bottom of our four layers of our TCP/IP stack, which is the Ethernet layer for getting one packet of information from one computer on a network to another computer on the same network, in our case, using the Ethernet protocol. And then we said that there were three more layers in the stack. So layer one is that link layer, one packet within your network. The second step up is then one packet from anywhere on the internet to anywhere else on the internet, and that's the IP layer. And then above that sits the layer for getting same streams of data from one place to another, which is your TCP and your UDP. And then on top of that sit our web browsers and our email clients and our chat clients and Skype and all of those things that actually use the internet or our network in some way.
Right.
So previously we were on the very bottom of the stack, and now we're moving up one to the second layer, which is the IP or the internet layer.
Okay.
So we had said that at the lowest layer, everything is addressed by MAC addresses. And unsurprisingly, when we move up to the IP layer, everything is addressed by IP addresses.
Okay, that makes sense.
We are ignoring IPv6 for the sake of this entire series. So as far as we are concerned, all IP addresses are of the form number.number.number.number.number. So four of them. And all of those numbers are between 0 and 255, inclusive.
Good.
So unlike our MAC addresses, they're not baked in. So your IP address is not a physical property of your network card. It's something that is controlled by your operating system. So it's a much more... It's configured rather than an innate, which is not really true of your MAC address. That's sort of baked in.
Right, right.
There's lots of them. If you 255 to the power of 255 to the power of 255 to the power of 255 is lots.
It's a way big number.
Way big number. And those are managed, so the parts of that massive space are handed out to organizations by ICANN, the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers. And they have set aside three very important bits, which are the ones that we are allowed to use for private networks. And a private network is one that's not either completely separate from the internet or is connected to the internet through a NAT router. And all of our home routers are almost certainly NAT routers. So in other words, those are the three ranges we are free to use within our homes.
For those playing at home, NAT stands for Network Address Translation.
It does, and it's something we will be coming back to later in the series. But for now, we just take it as given that it's a cool thing our home routers do.
Okay.
So those three ranges are 10.0.0.0 up to 10.255.255.255, which is, I think, Apple like that one.
Right, right.
And then there's 172.16.0.0 to 172.31.255.255, and you don't really tend to see that one very often.
And that's a weird one. I wonder why it's 31 instead of all 255s after the 172.
Well, because you can have them of any size, and I think it's because of that 31 that we don't use it very much, because it confuses people. I think actually that's why it's just left there.
By the way, I have seen that address before inside a business.
Yeah, perfectly valid. Again, it's private networks are free for anyone to use.
Mm-hmm.
And then 192.168.0.0 to 192.168.255.255, that's used by most routers that are not made by Apple.
Yeah, yeah. Now, an important thing to note is you could have a company that had this 172 range, and I could have a company that had the 172 range, mm-hmm. and that doesn't hurt anything because they're both behind our routers, and so they're not on the public network, right?
Exactly. They are both private networks, and they have to be private networks. So these private address ranges are free for us to use in our homes, but the corollary to that is that you may not, under any circumstances whatsoever, use those on the public internet.
Right. That would break everything.
Oh, yeah. Well, it would probably break you more than anything else, but it wouldn't work. And yeah, it's verboten not to be done. We also mentioned that 127, that anything is entirely reserved for the loopback address, which is a terrible waste of IP addresses, but so be it. And addresses starting in 169.254 are self-signed addresses and usually a sign that something is broken.
Right, right.
So the big step up here with going up from Ethernet to IP is this ability to cross different networks and get from one part of the internet to another part of the internet. And the heavy lifting in that is the routing, which is figuring out a path between these two points and getting the packet across that path. And most of the routing is done by routers, or routers, as you guys call them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really cool how that works, but we're not going to talk about it because it's a whole university course, right? It's not straightforward. It is cool, but it's not straightforward, and it's not really directly related to our terminal or to our home network, so we're not going there. But everything that talks IP does a small amount of routing because it has to answer a question. Just one question it has to try and answer. Is the destination IP address for this packet on my local network or is it on a different network?
Hmm.
And every time your computer sends a single packet, so it's doing it thousands of times a second while we're chatting on Skype, it has to figure out, oh, that IP address for Allison, is that here or is that not here? If it's not here, I hand it to Bart's router and then Bart's router will make it go the rest of the way. If it is here, I just send it directly. So that is basically the most fundamental routing question. Is this packet for my network or for another network? If it's for my network, I send it myself using Ethernet. If it's for another network, I can't send it myself using Ethernet. So I send it to my router, and my router then takes it from there.
So your computer needs to answer this question?
Yes.
Okay.
Every single time your computer issues an IP packet, it has to answer that question.
Okay. Okay.
And that will determine whether the packet goes to
the
MAC address.
That's before it sends.
Before it hits, yeah, exactly. So before it sends. So it has to decide, does this packet go to the MAC address of the final destination or to the MAC address of my router?
How's it going to know the MAC address? You mean I...
Yeah, using ARP, like we talked about in part 24.
Okay. I forgot that part, but okay. I believe you.
Yes. And we saw that with the ARP-A command. We could see that. So in order to answer that question, what we're actually asking is the destination on my subnet, is what we're asking in fancy computer science words.
Right.
So basically your subnet is the IP equivalent of your network. So a subnet is just a collection of IP addresses that are related to each other in that, well, we'll get ahead of it in a minute. So they're all related IP addresses. And very importantly, everyone on a subnet can send a packet directly to everyone else on the subnet without the help of a router. That's what defines its subnettiness.
Oh, I didn't catch that last week. So if my computer determines that the computer I need to talk to is on the same subnet, then I never talk to the router at all?
Correct. You go direct.
Really?
Yes.
Really?
Yes, which is why it's a routing decision. So the decision is give it to the router or do it myself.
I definitely missed that.
Okay, that's very important actually because the whole reason we have this concept of a subnet mask that we're going to get so deep into is because that is the mechanism for telling your computer what's local and what's foreign, i.e. what do I send to myself or what do I give to the router?
Yeah, I got that it was going to do that, but I didn't get that if it didn't need... Well, the first part of what you said, I didn't get the part where it actually doesn't have to go through the router at all, if it's local.
If it's local, no router involved. It just uses RUP to figure out the MAC address and sends the packet directly using Ethernet. And off it goes. That's it, done. Because there's no need for a router, because you can talk straight to that guy because he's on your subnet.
Huh.
So you just do.
Okay.
So really...
I believe you. It seems counterintuitive, but I believe you.
Okay, well, it's, you know, it's what makes IP different to Ethernet, is that IP can go far enough if it has to, but it prefers not to.
Right.
It's easier. It's always easier not to leave your network. So IP addresses, we're used to seeing them in this dotted notation, which are called dotted quads. But in reality, it's actually a 32-bit binary number. So it's 32 ones or zeros. And that binary, in their binary form, you can see the patterns, whereas in their decimal form, you sometimes can't. Sometimes you can, but that's a special case rather than the definition. So everyone who's on your subnet, when you write their IP addresses out as ones and zeros, will start with the same ones and zeros. How much of it you choose to keep in common determines the size of your subnet. So if you say that the first 24 bits of my IP address have to be the same, then you have a 24-bit subnet, and every single computer has to share those same 24 bits in their IP address to be on your network.
Right. I remember this
part. Or you might decide to say, I want millions and millions of computers, so I'm going to make only the first 8 say the same and let all the others vary. And then you have a short bit in common, so lots of variability, so lots and lots and lots of IP addresses available to you.
That would be really dumb. You don't want to have a giant, giant subnet, right? Because that means every machine is talking to every other machine on the subnet.
Yeah, using Ethernet, which, as we heard about last time, has this habit of colliding into itself.
Right, right. So that would be dumb.
It is how, in the past, such things did happen when there was much, you know, when we didn't download movies and stuff. You could do that if everyone was using a teeny tiny bit of bandwidth. But no, in the modern world, that is never going to fly. Never going to fly. So ultimately, what we need to define is this. Where we draw the line. So how much do we let wobble and how much do we keep constant? And the name we give for our definition of how much is constant and how much is wobbly is a subnet mask, or just a net mask. And we write the net mask as a second binary number. Again, 32 bits long. And we say that all the bits we keep constant get a 1 in the subnet mask. And all the bits we let wobble get zeros. So subnet masks are always a bunch of 1s and then a bunch of zeros. And anything that doesn't fit that pattern is an illegal subnet mask.
That's when it's not being shown as a quad, whatever you called it, octet?
Dotted quad.
Dotted quad, right.
So a lot of IP, so in order to really see if a net mask is valid, you have to write it in binary. It's the only way to really see it, because from the decimal, you can't tell. So, the basic math, right? So we have these two binary numbers, and that's all our computer. So when we're configuring our computer, those are the two things we tell our computer about its IP presence. Here's your IP address, here's your netmask. And based on just those two pieces of information, it can figure out all the rest. So what it needs to figure out is whether or not someone is local with it.
Right.
So it takes its IP address, or your computer takes its IP address. It then does a binary AND with your netmask. So we described last time that a binary AND is... It's defined by a little truth table that we have in the show notes here. So 0 and 0 is 0. 0 and 1 is 0. 1 and 0 is 0. 1 and 1 is 1. Every computer science undergrad can just rattle that off. So we do that 32 times. And then we end up with a new 32... long thing. And that 32 long thing we call our network address.
And that's now the combination of the IP address and the netmask.
Yes. So, Alicia, so we AND the IP address and the netmask, and we get this new 32-bit number, and we're going to call that our network address, is the name we're going to give that. It looks just like an IP address. You would write it like you would an IP address as a dotted quad. And if you look at it in binary, it'll have the same prefix as all the computers on your network and then all zeros for the rest. So all the wobbly bits go to zero.
Okay.
So we now need to ask the question. Let's make this real world, right? We are computer A. That's not an imaginative name, but we are computer A.
Okay.
Our computer has the IP address 192.168.0.3, and it has the Netmask 255.255.255.248.
Alrighty.
I want to talk to two different computers. I want to talk to computer B, which has an IP address of 192.168.0.5, and I want to talk to computer C, which has an IP address of 192.168.0.9.
Okay.
Now,
so just for people listening, I know it's a little hard when you hear all those numbers. We're basically, we're on dot 3. The other two computers are dot 5 and dot 9.
Correct. And okay. Our netmask is 3255s and a 248 on the end.
Okay.
Now, notice something. This is where I went off the rails last time. Your computer has no idea what the... Right. A netmask is an internal configuration. It is a property of your settings inside your computer. It is not public knowledge. It is not published. It is not shared in any way. So you do not know the netmask that is set on another computer.
Oh. Well,
yeah, I went
that's going to make this hard to figure out.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't actually make it any harder.
Okay.
But I just got that. I wasn't clear on that. I knew that. I just didn't say that. That made things messy. So we would like to send information to those two computers, and we now need to figure out, are you local or are you foreign? So first thing we do is we do some conversions. So we just write them all out in binary. So we have four 32-bit binary numbers, the three IP addresses, and our netmask.
Right.
So we already know that if we take our netmask and we AND it with our own IP address, we get back our network address. So we do that and we keep a copy.
Okay.
We then take our netmask and the first of the two IP addresses we want to send to. So we'll take .5 and we AND those together. And then we see if it's the same as our net address. If it is the
same. Our net address and their net address would be the same?
If they're the same, then he's local.
Ah.
And we can send direct.
Oh, that's why you don't need to know the other computer's netmask. Because if you do it with your netmask and it's the same, then they have the same netmask. If it's different, then they have a different netmask, which means they're on a different subnet.
Yeah, they may be on a different subnet
or internet.
The same netmask, but you can't talk local. You can't talk directly to anyone who doesn't calculate down in the same way.
Wait. You just said they can have the same.
Mm-hmm. They can have the same
netmask,
right? But have a different IP address. So okay, let's take a very common netmask: 3255s and a zero.
Okay.
I can be 192.168.0.52.
Mm-hmm.
So when I calculate that down, my network address is 192.168.0.0.
Okay.
You might be 192.168.20.52, and your netmask could be the same as mine, so 3255s. Your network address would be 192.168.20.0.
Okay, that's a whole lot of numbers jumbling by. Let me change the way I'm going to ask my question. If, let's say you and I both have Apple routers, and we both have, you've assigned your computer 10.0.1.1, well, you wouldn't do that, 10.0.1.10, and I've named mine 10.0.1.10, and we've both used a netmask of 255.255.255.0, then this math would say we're on the same subnet. And we're not.
Yes, in fact, this math would say we're the same... Okay, you're bringing NAT into it, and that's a bad idea.
Well, if I've got to be able to tell whether you're inside or outside the network.
Okay, but you're not sending to me as my 10 address. You're sending it to me as my public IP address.
Okay, so this all this math only refers to... Oh, wait a minute. I thought you said this...
It refers to the IP address that you, as the sender, see. So the fact that NAT routers manipulate IP addresses... changes what I see.
Okay, so as long as it's not a 192, then all you need to do is see whether it's in those ranges of IP addresses we're not allowed to use. Why do you need the netmask for that? Because you already told us we're not allowed to use the 172s and the 10.0s and the 172 and the 192s or the 169. So you go in and you say, okay, it's not one of those. Boom, it's outside.
No, because I could have. In fact, I do. You do too. You have two private subnets within your house, so do I.
And that's what I wanted to hear you say. So this all this math is to see if it's inside your network, but on a different subnet, not if it's outside your network. If it's outside your network, you wouldn't need to do any of this math.
Okay, so as far as we're concerned, when I say network, I mean subnet. So if you have two networks in your house...
Yeah, I'm going to need you to be precise on that, because that's going to confuse me if you say it that way.
Okay.
Okay.
the strict definition of a subnet is that everyone can talk to each other. So if you have two subnets within your house, you have two networks within your house. They're physically right on top of each other, but logically they're
separate. True, but not precise enough.
Okay.
Because when I think network, I think out everybody. So if we say subnet, so now I'm caught up with why we're doing this. I did not catch that last time. All right.
Okay. And so, remember, this logic is entirely generic. So if we didn't have NAT routers, and if we were, I don't know, a large university that owned public IP addresses, the same logic would be applied. So the fact that NAT is in the way doesn't change the math that has to be done. You always have to figure out, are you on my subnet or are you not on my subnet? Whether or not there's NATiness done by your router doesn't affect this math. You always have to do it.
Okay, but you wouldn't have to do this if you weren't talking about subnets. Because you can just look and see if it's in a range that's disallowed, then I would do it. Or actually,
yes, but you're applying too much importance to the arbitrary numbers that have been chosen by ICANN as being private. So the actual how IP works doesn't understand that at all. It's just binary numbers, and we're doing binary math.
Oh, sure, sure. Yeah. But they could have done it that way, is what I'm saying, if it weren't for subnets. Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Now we'll have our examples, and when we do the math, we see that two of them work out to the same and one of them doesn't. But let's reinforce that. So I spent most of this week writing a little webpage called subnetcalc.it.
And I have no idea what this does. I looked at it and I went, what on earth is he talking about?
Okay. So the important thing is we know two pieces of information about our computer. We know our IP address and we know our netmask. So those are the only two pieces of information you put into subnetcalc.it, and it will then tell you about your network and let you test if an IP address is on your network or not. It will do all of this math I have just described. So you could go straight to the link and type it in, or you could click on the special link in the show notes that will pre-fill the text fields for you with the examples from the show notes here. So this is where it says this link. You may have to do a shift refresh because you may have cached an old version of this page because you were beta testing for me.
Wait, no. I just opened up subnetcalc.it on its own. I just clicked the link in the sidebar.
Just after that. Okay, so in the actual show note text, it says you can use this link to load the IP address and netmask automatically.
Yeah, you're going to have to tell me where that is. I'm scrolling and not finding...
You see the IPA and it's where computer A, computer B, computer C, a little bit down from that.
Okay. I got computer A, computer B, computer C.
Then you have four lines with a whole bunch of ones and zeros, a paragraph of text, three lines with a whole bunch of zeros, one single line of text.
There it is. Okay.
Now, all that's done is save you copying and pasting, right? You could have copied and pasted 192.168.0.
Not found error 404.
What?
Oh, is that a bad... Yeah, you've got some www.subnetcalc.it at the end of the IP address.
Oh, lovely.
So I can get to what you're talking about, and you can fix that later.
Interesting, it worked for me.
No.
How come I got there?
Okay. It's not the one that says this link. It's the one right before that is messed up.
Oh, okay. I'll fix that one.
Okay, now I'm with you.
Okay, phew.
Except, so, God, could you make that text any smaller, Bart? Jeez. Give me a eye break. Okay, I've zoomed it up.
Okay. So, the first thing is, now, if you want to see the simpler view, you can click hide calculations, and it's going to hide all the binary stuff it's really doing and only show you the answers.
Okay.
Which is probably what most people want.
What problem does this solve?
This is going to show us everything that so we know that our computers contain only two settings, IP address and netmask. Mm-hmm. And using those two settings, our computer learns everything it needs to know about our subnet. And it does that with math. But I can show you by doing the math for you. So we have the IP address 192.168.0.3 with the netmask 3255 and a 258. The first thing, so if you hide the calculations and keep it just to the vital statistics, the first thing is that we can write that subnet in three ways that are all listed here. So if you see 192.168.0.0/29 or 192.168.0.0/255.255.255.248 or 192.168.0.0 and then all these FF8s and stuff, those, if you see any of those, they all mean the same thing. They mean our network. So if someone asks you, what's your network, you can tell them it's all of three of these things.
Okay.
It also does the math and works out what your network address is. So we know our IP is 0.3 and our netmask is what it is, but our network address, that actually calculates down to 192.168.0.0.
Okay.
Our broadcast address that we're going to learn about in a minute calculates down to 192.168.0.7.
Okay.
And the usable IP addresses on our network are 192.168.0.1 up to and including 0.6. In other words, there are only six computers in our little subnet.
Okay.
And down the bottom, we have a little thing called an IP tester. So you type in the other two IP addresses that we are testing. So 192.168. And that would help if 0. I could type.
0.5, right?
.0.5. I really can't type today. I'm putting in commas instead of dots, and that doesn't work. 0.168. And you will see it says, yes, that is in your subnet. Now you put in 9, 0.9. It says, no, you're not in our subnet. So this is just done for you, everything we just talked about in the show notes.
Okay.
And if you click show calculations, it will show you exactly how it's done it with all of the binary. So everything I have said is shown here graphically.
This, no.
No?
Nope. Not at all getting it. So if I've got a Linksys router, and I have control of the IP address range, I can, on one subnet, assign one computer 192.168.0.3, and I can give another one 192.168.0.9, and those are on the same subnet.
No. Well, only... Right, you can't answer that question without knowing the netmask. If you use a netmask of 3.255s and a 2.48, they are not on the same subnet. So you use a different netmask. If you change that netmask to 3.255s and a 0, they will be on the same subnet.
Why would I? I mean, why?
Okay, well,
I get a router and it automatically populates at 255.255.255.0. Every router I've ever gotten has said that. So why would I change it to 2.48 to make my network not work and have computers on the same subnet?
Make your network not work. Well, no, they're not on the same subnet, right? If you may want smaller subnets, okay. Imagine.
So, is this a way to create subnets?
Right. So if you if you just use your router the way it was configured, you're getting the defaults. But imagine that you want to actually configure stuff yourself, and you say, I need two networks here. Well, then you're going to pick two different sets of networks, and you might say, well, I only need eight computers in this one, so I'll make a small subnet.
The way you make that small subnet is by putting in that subnet mask that causes these things to fall into different places?
Correct. So by choosing the size of your subnet mask, you choose the size of your network. So imagine, this is actually real money, right? So imagine that you are a school, maybe a university, big enough to buy real IP addresses that cost money. You buy 256 of them because you can't really afford any more than that. And you need two networks. If you used a Class C 255.255.255.0 network netmask, you would only get one network, but you need two. Well, if you change the netmask to one that is a little bit smaller than that, say 3.255s and a 128, is it? Yeah, 128. Then you get two subnets. You split it in half. If you change that again, you could quarter it. You could eighth it. You could sixteenth it.
Okay. Now that I understand that the purpose of the subnet, that this isn't a just random result. It's why you have it. A different subnet mask would be to create these multiple subnets.
Yes. So basically, if you are saying, I only need eight machines, I'm going to pick a nice small subnet, then you would pick a net mask that gives you a very small subnet.
Okay. I got you.
Okay.
All right.
Good. So
now the IP, now I don't hate this IP subnet calculator because I understand why it would be different is because you wanted it to be different. Not just because, oh crap, I can't pick 0.9 now.
Right, exactly. You would have done that for a reason. So you can see what your subnet means, because usually the way it happens for us as end users, right, is that some network guy has picked the subnet and we've plugged in our computer. The HTTP has given us the details. And so we kind of want to work backwards and see what settings he created. So we would stick in the only two things we can see, which is our IP address and our netmask. And then this calculator will work back from that and tell us the details.
Cool.
So in our homes, what we have is the default Apple made up for us.
Interesting. So. Okay.
So while we're here, we may as well do what the default is. So your home network, if you just buy an Apple router, you plug it in, you're 10.0.0.something for your IP address. So pick a number. 42. I like 42. And then 3.255s and a 0. And if you hit calculate. What is created for you by a default Apple router.
Sorry, I can't play with mine because mine's on 192s because we're running my Airport Extreme off of another router from Verizon.
Okay, well, if you type in the details for the 10 address, you will see what everyone else who has an Apple router is getting.
Okay, so for IP address, I'm typing in what?
10.0.0.42, let's say.
Okay.
And then 3.2.5.0.1.
No?
Is that what Apple uses? Okay, that's what Apple uses. We'll type in a 1. So 10.0.1.42, and then 3.2.5.5 is in a 0, and then you hit calculate.
Okay.
And all the numbers change.
The calculate button... No, it does not like 10.0.1.41. It's got a red danger symbol.
Where have you typed that in?
For IP address.
And there's not a comma instead of a dot?
Nope. And I got
there's no space anywhere.
If
you get a bright red thingy, then there's a typo.
10.0.1.42. Okay, I liked it that time. Okay, calculate. All right.
And what that will tell us is that if you're using your router out of the box, there are 254 possible IP addresses in your house between 10.0.1.1, 10.0.1.254.
Ah. Oh, I didn't look at that before to see how many I had the last time.
Well, the last time we were using the teeny tiny netmask of mine, the 248 netmask, you were getting 6.
Right, but I wanted to see it. I want to see it in that hide calculations. I want to see it. 6 hosts. Okay, now I got it.
Okay. And so your default setting is that your network address is 10.0.1.0, your broadcast is 10.0.1.255, and you have 254 addresses from 1.1 up to 1.254.
Okay.
And then if you wanted to check if an IP address was in the network or not, you could type it in there and it would say yes or no. And if you want to see the actual mathematics, you click Show Calculations and it will show you all the binary and show you everything it's doing, which is everything we've just talked about.
255 is the biggest number you can put in, right?
Correct, because
then I've just found a mistake in your math.
You have? Where?
Yep. So I put in the IP address of 10.0.1.42, netmask at 255.255.255.0, and then just for fun, I tried testing the IP address 10.0.1.256, and it says, yep, it's in the subnet.
10.0.1.
It doesn't have a, hey, moron, that's not a real IP address.
Mine filter. Goes red when I try that.
Well,
you are very good at finding bugs. We'll have to find that bug offline.
I am. I'm going to drop it into the chat just in case just to prove it was there.
I believe you.
Just so we can come back to this. Okay, that's just Allison trying to break things.
Okay, so hopefully the whole point of this interface is by having the hide and show calculations button is to let you really explore what's going on and to put some examples into the math we talk about. And also to let you take the two settings you know, which is your IP address and your netmask, and see what they mean.
Yeah.
So let's get back to the show notes.
Okay.
So we've done all that. So the structure of a subnet is that the first address is one you may not use, which is why you have 254 that you're allowed out of the 256 possible ones. So the first one you cannot use because it's the network address. The last one you also can't use. Because it's the very special address called the broadcast address.
Which is the last one? I lost you.
So if you imagine our big binary number, or you can do it as dotted quad. So if you have the default Apple subnet, 10.0.1.anything, then 10.0.1.255 would be the broadcast address, because it's the last IP address in the range.
Okay.
So the highest number within the range is the broadcast address by definition.
And you can't use it.
You can't use it as a computer. So you can't give your computer that IP address, but you can send packets to it. And if you send a packet to it, what happens is that packet goes to every single computer on the subnet, which is why it's called the broadcast address. So it's like shouting at every computer on your network. And this is very, very important. And it's because of this fact, actually, that a lot of people's home sharing breaks by accident. And this is actually why we care about netmasks at all.
Okay.
If you care about how you calculate the broadcast address, the math is in the show notes. I'm going to skip it. Last time we talked about the fact that we can represent our netmasks as either it's IP network address / subnet mask gives us a representation of a subnet. So 192.168.0.0/255.255.255, whatever.
Right. We went through all that.
So where we stopped last time was that, so any amount of ones followed by enough zeros to make it 32 long is allowed as a subnet mask. So you can have all of these bizarre masks like my 2481 in the example above. But in the real world, you tend not to meet those funny ones. You tend to meet ones which, when you write them out as dotted quads, are a bunch of 255s and then a bunch of zeros. They're special case, extra friendly, nice to use subnet masks. And there's three of them. You still there?
Yeah, I can't figure out where you are in the show notes, so I'm just scrolling trying to follow you.
Real world simplifications is the name of the section.
Okay, got it. Thank you.
So any number of ones and zeros between 0 and 32 is okay. But in the real world, we actually meet, there's two of them we meet really often, and one of them we used to meet often in the olden days. And so 8 bits equates to 255 and then 3 zeros, and that's called a Class A network. Huge thing. It contains 16,777,214 IP addresses. No one really uses that. The one you might bump into is a Class B, which is 2 255s and 2 zeros, which is a 16-bit mask. And that gives you 65,534 IP addresses. But the one us home users, and even in a corporate environment, the one you're most likely to bump into is 3 255s and a zero, which is a 24-bit mask, 254 machines, and it's known as a Class C network.
So that's what we're really going to see.
Yeah. So in reality, if you understand a Class C net mask and what that means, you're done. Right? In the real world, that's probably enough to get by. It's just understanding Class C. So what does it mean to be a Class C? What it means is that the network address for your network is the first 3 bits of your IP address with the last one changed to a zero.
Wait.
So if you're in a Class C network, what
can,
is my network?
Can be a zero.
No. Your network address.
Oh, that again.
Is
okay.
Defined as, right, the first IP address in your series. So it's going to be whatever the first 3 digits of your IP address are, and then you put the last one to zero, and you have now calculated your network address without any binary anywhere in sight.
So if I've got a Linksys router with the 192.168, so it'd be 192.168.0.0. Why is it a zero? It'd be 1.0.
Do Linksys by default give 192.168.1.something or .0.something? Oh, okay. Yes, and it will be 1.0. Yes.
Okay.
And your broadcast address will be 192.168.1.255. So you basically take the 3 bits of the IP and you make the last one a 255. There's your broadcast address.
Okay.
Is someone in my network or not becomes a question of, are the first 3 parts of the IP the same? If the answer is yes, they're in my network. If the answer is no, they're not in my network.
Okay.
So all of that math can be blown down to those 3 simple patterns, assuming we're using the special case Class C network. So, now that we understand Class C networks and why they're a special case, and we know enough to go look up how to do the not Class C networks, but in reality, as long as we know the Class Cs, we're golden. So, when we look on our computer, there are 3 settings that have to be right if your computer is going to work. So, IP address has to be set. Netmask has to be set. And the 3rd very important setting is you have to have configured into your computer the IP address of your router.
Okay.
Which is known as the default route or the default gateway. So we use the IP address and the netmask to calculate if our destination is local or foreign. If we find out it's local, we send the direct. But if we find out it's foreign, we have to be able to send it to a router.
Oh, right.
And unless we tell our computer what the router is, how can we do that? Right? So those 3 settings are king. And so it's important you know how to read, how to find those. So if you're on OS X and you open up the network system preference pane, you can see them written out there straight in front of you. It says IP address, subnet mask, router. That are those 3 vital pieces of information.
Now that's auto-filled for us nowadays.
Because the chances are the Dropbox above it says using DHCP.
Yeah.
Okay. If you're on the terminal, you can, of course, also find this information.
Ooh. Finally, so we opened the terminal.
Yeah, because now we know
what
the output. Now we know what the output means.
All right.
So we can see all these 3 pieces of information by running 2 terminal commands: ifconfig -a, which will show all of our network cards and what IP addresses they have, which will
We've
tell
done
us
that
our IP address.
Before.
And the other one we haven't probably done before is netstat -rn. Now, netstat is a beast of a command that we'll come back to in the future, but the -rn flag will make it show us the routing table of our computer. And on OS X, the routing table is huge. On every other version of Linux I've ever used, the routing table is tiny. What we're interested in is the line that starts with the magic word default, because that your default root is the IP address of your router. So if you run that command, you'll see there's a line that says default, and that's the one that tells you what your router's IP address is.
Yeah, there's two lines that say default, and they both say the same router address.
Two network cards, probably.
Could be. Yep.
So both of those give a lot of output. And we learned all about this grep thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what if we actually only want to see the real facts? Well, you can copy and paste from the show notes. Basically, it's ifconfig minus a, and then we pipe it into egrep, where we look for the pattern inet at the edge of a word. So slash b is a word boundary. And then we pipe it back into egrep for a second run through. And minus v, remember, means to search for things that do not contain. So we're saying everything that that has inet as a word and doesn't contain 127 dot, because we want to get out these 127.0.0 addresses.
Why just the 127s you don't want to see?
Because they're just the loopback address. So anything
that's right.
Every other IP address we care about.
Okay.
So you probably have two, because you probably have your Wi-Fi on your Ethernet enabled.
Active, yeah.
Whereas I only have my Ethernet plugged in, so I'm only going to get one back.
Okay.
Now, what you should notice is that OS X and its infinite wisdom represents net masks using hexadecimal. Thankfully, yes. You can copy and paste that into my little calculator and it will interpret it just fine.
Oh. But I closed your little calculator because you told us to.
I know. I'm just saying. The point being, you should be able to put the information that you see either from the command line or from your Windows control panel or from whatever into that calculator. So the netstat command then, this time we're just grepping for the magic word default at the start of a line, and that should just show us our default root, which in my case will be 1 because I only have one network card active. You probably see 2.
Wait, did you do a second?
So there's another. Okay, so there's
so netstat, run the second
command. Pipe egrep, blah, blah, blah.
Okay, and I'm just doing garbage in, garbage out now, not following you. So we just did the ifconfig to pull out everything that didn't have 127 had init in it. What does this second one do?
We are looking for lines beginning with the word default.
Okay.
So hat symbol, default.
Okay, so that just gave me my first two lines like I had before.
Yes, which are the ones we care about. So you're basically getting to your router through your wireless card and your wired card. At the very end of the line, one of them probably says EN something and the other one says EN something else.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, so that's your two devices that are both active, right. So they can both get out to the internet
right.
Through the same IP address. So if you look, I have there for people, if you want to follow along, the outputs from my computer with the three pieces of information that are the triumvirate that make our network work, highlighted in bold, just to show you where they look. So you can see that I have my IP address is 192.168.10.42. I didn't make that up. That is genuinely my IP address. I programmed that into my router. Because I want 42. And then you see the mask is a class C, and that my router is 192.168.10.1.
Where do I see it's class C?
Because 0x...
Oh, no. Don't do that. I thought you said it said class C. It doesn't.
It's just it is. Okay,
gotcha.
Do that.
Okay.
So why does all this matter, right? This is the biggest reason that people's home networks don't work. Right? So that's why all this has been leading up to this, hopefully, tip for make everyone's network run more smoothly. So you would imagine that the whole point of IP is to take one packet from anywhere on the internet to anywhere else on the internet. So surely to goodness, everything that uses IP can travel across the internet. Isn't that the point? So everything that uses TCP or UDP, which sit on top of IP, should be able to go anywhere. But that's not true. And the reason it's not true is because of the broadcast address. So a broadcast packet never leaves your subnet. So any protocol that relies on IP broadcasts cannot work outside of your local network.
Okay.
Right. So if a protocol relies on broadcasts, it is confined by the range that those broadcasts reach. So if you think of it like you can't shout to the planet, you can only shout to the people next to you.
Okay.
So an IP broadcast is a packet to every machine on your subnet. It
right.
never leaves your subnet, so that traffic can't leave your network. It's trapped because it's using broadcasts. And so any protocol that does that is called unrootable, because it can't cross your router.
Okay.
So why do we care about this? We care about this because Apple absolutely adore unrootable protocols. Right? And the reason they adore them is because they allow you to do some really convenient trade-offs. If a protocol is rootable, you need security, because anyone, anywhere on the internet, can in theory get to it. So you would need passwords and everything. But an unrootable protocol cannot be attacked from outside of your subnet. So in other words, it is trapped in your house. So that's why AirPlay doesn't need a password. You can set one if you like, but it doesn't need one. And the reason that anyone else on the planet can't get to it is because it's an unrootable protocol. So iTunes sharing, printer sharing, anything, in fact, that uses Apple's Bonjour technology is unrootable. And that's actually a feature, not a bug.
And Apple didn't invent that, though. I thought that like it's in HP printers and things like that, too.
I actually think Apple invented it but made it public. As in, Apple also owned the common Unix printing stack, but they didn't invent that. They own it. Anyway, I don't know, so let's just say no more.
But you know I'll check you.
Yeah. Apple, though, are very, very fond of these unrootable protocols because they allow sharing without wasting your effort on security while still being secure, because it's all trapped within your house. So that's why, like, all of this new continuity stuff where your iPhone can magically share with your computers and stuff, all unrootable protocols, all based on IP broadcasts. So these unrootable protocols rock.
By the way, Wikipedia says, whether this is right or not, Bonjour is Apple's implementation of zero configuration networking, zeroconf. A
that
group of
sense.
Technologies that include service discovery, address assignment, and hostname resolution.
That makes sense.
Okay.
We'll probably be coming back to that later in the series, actually, because it's a form of DNS.
Okay.
And so it's also called MDNS. Anyway, so where things often go wrong is when so usually in your home network, you want all of your devices on the same subnet. Now, you and I both have two subnets, but one of those subnets is empty, and one of them has all of our devices on them. And the reason we want all of our devices on the same network is so that they can share with each other. And the reason people often end up pulling their hair out is because they accidentally, without meaning to, split their network in half. And then that means that broadcasts are only reaching some machines. And so maybe my computer can reach the Apple TV just fine, but yours can't. But why? Why? I have my iTunes library shared. The Apple TV can see it, but you can't. Or you can see it, but the Apple TV can't. Or you can print, but I can't. All of these kind of weird issues are almost, not always, but almost always down to you've accidentally chopped your network into two subnets. And the reason it looks random is because if you happen to both be on one of the two halves, it'll work. But as soon as one party is on the other half, it stops working, and it can look really arbitrary and really weird.
You should have told us this at the beginning. I would have had more motivation. I mean, I did pay attention, but I was like, I don't know where I'm ever going to use this.
This is where. And in fact,
what problem are we trying to solve, part?
I probably should have put that first, actually. You're right. I was trying to keep it as a... Okay. So let's start
as a spoiler.
Let's start with the out-of-the-box network almost everyone has, right? So you buy your first internet router, you plug everything in, you end up with a network that looks like the one we talked about last time. So you see there, a little bubble for the cloud, our home router with its three components, the routing component, the Ethernet switch component, and the wireless access point component. All of your devices are connected either by a copper wire or by wireless. And so there's a little blue box there that shows the reach of your home network, right? So it's one unified sort of blue fuzzy box where they're all together. They can all yap away to each other and share away just fine. Then you realize you've terrible Wi-Fi in the back bedroom. It's just awful. So you buy a second device. And you plug it in.
Ah.
So you stick it into the Ethernet switch.
Yeah, they
do. And then the question is, how do you configure it? Because that little box contains three components. And if you configure those three components one way, you get one giant network. If you configure that same box differently, you get two. And so I have a diagram of the bad and the good, right? So in the bad, we have enabled the routing feature of the second access point, which means that we now have subnet one, the one we intended, and a whole separate subnet called subnet two, which is the accidental one, which has the devices that are further away from you, they're in the back bedroom, are on an island. We didn't mean them to be on an island, we just misconfigured our access point. So the correct way to do it is to configure your second device so the router component is turned off. So you can see it's out of the way there in red in the second diagram. And now you have one giant big network again.
Yeah.
And everything is fine.
Right.
So the way you could tell if you had condition one, right? That's the right. So if people had come to me and say, oh, I can't share, I need to know, have you accidentally done one instead of two? And the way I tell is by checking the net masks and stuff like we've been talking about.
So you have to go inside their network to do that though, right?
Well, what I would just ask them, what I would do to you, because we did this years and years ago when you were having trouble sharing something on your network, and I would say to you, what's the IP address and net mask on that computer? And what's the IP address and net mask on that other computer? Now, when we are checking this, we know more than our computers know when they're just... So when we were talking about using subnet masks to route traffic, we said that our computer only knows our net mask. It doesn't know the net mask of the other IP.
Right.
But if we are trying to fix our network, we know everyone's IP and everyone's subnet because we can just read it.
Right. Okay?
So we know more than the computer does. So if we are having sharing trouble... So these two devices suddenly can't share anymore. We now have two devices. We look up using the GUI or whatever. Give me a MAC address. Give me an IP address. Give me a netmask. Give me an IP address. Give me a netmask. Okay, are these on the same network or not? The simplest check to do is first to see, are the two of them actually configured to use the same netmask? If the answer is no, then straight away you know you split your network by mistake.
Right.
They couldn't possibly be on the same subnet. They have a different netmask. Chances are you won't find the answer to that question to be no, because almost everyone uses Class Cs, so they're probably going to be the same. But that still doesn't mean they're on the same network. Then you have to go further. So then you need to figure out if they share the same subnet. So you can either do it with the math, or you can follow this diagram. And the nice thing about the diagram is because almost everyone has a Class C, you stay in the top little corner of the diagram, you don't go any further.
Let me see if I can walk through this again. So I'm looking at the diagram right now. So the first question, netmask the same, yes or no? No. Hey, moron, they're not on the same subnet. I got that one.
Right. The chances are then the answer is yes.
So if it's Class C, that means it's going to go from 0 to 254 within some within the IP address range. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if we walk through the diagram, so we have gathered our IP addresses and our netmasks. The netmask is the same, so we've decided they're both Class C. So then we fall into this next box, which says, is the netmask 255.255.255.0 or one of the other two ways of writing the same thing?
So back up, though. This is why I wanted to try to say it in my own words. If I went out and got a little network extender thingy and I plugged it in, or another Airport Extreme and plugged it in, I would have to have actively gone in and said, don't make it 255.255.255.0. I would have had to actively do that, right? So accidentally is not going to ever do this.
Unless they're from different vendors. I have seen wireless access points that use a Class B. I haven't seen many of them. I believe I've seen one.
So 99% of the time, we're just going to hit that red button right away that says not on same subnet, because the netmasks are going to be different. No, they're usually going
to
be the same.
We're almost never going to get to go out in the red box, I'm afraid.
I'm sorry. I said it backwards.
We have to do more work.
I said it backwards. So they're almost always going to be the same. They're going to have 255.255.255.0, right?
Yes.
So we're going to go to the yes. So how...
Okay.
But maybe I've missed the fundamental thing again, but I don't see how they aren't going to be on the same subnet.
Okay. Well, let's follow it through. So we go yes out of the first box. So we ask the question, are you a Class C? And if you answer yes again, then this is the key question. Are the first three parts of the IP address the same?
Okay, so here's where maybe I could see it be different, that if you had a Netgear and a Linksys together, Linksys does 192.168.1. whatever, and I think Netgear does 192.168.0. whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where you could start getting this problem, right?
Right, but I'm pretty sure if you plug two Airport Extremes into each other, it would detect, it would use DHCP to find out what its port is, what its IP address is on the inside, so facing your other router, and it would never use the same address to give out IP addresses behind itself, because it would break completely. So you would actually probably find, if you just took them out of the box, you'd find that one of them goes to 10.0.1.blah, and the other one goes to 10.0.2.blah.
Oh, so it would auto-detect that there's another one here, and I better use something else.
Right, because it would. You can't have the same network on two sides of a router if it's in router mode, because that's like a snake eating its own tail.
Yeah. Okay.
The 5.0. Yeah.
Okay. So now I'm with you because I was thinking, well, they would both pick the same thing. Why wouldn't that work?
No, they should. If they did both pick the same thing, you would know it was broken because nothing would work.
It would be a simpler demise.
It would be a simpler problem. And so usually, actually, when people go through this flow, they only ever go into three yellow triangles. Are the masks the same? Almost certainly yes. Is it a Class C? Almost certainly yes. And then you get to the real question, are the first three parts of the IPs the same? If the answer is yes, you're all on the one subnet, and whatever your problem is, you can rule that one
else.
Out.
Okay.
It's something else.
Okay.
But likelihood is, if what your only symptom is that you can't share stuff, you're probably going to find that the answer is actually no, and then you need to go in and reconfigure that second router probably into something like, they all have different words for it, like access point mode or bridge mode or not a router mode, basically. And then check again, and then this time you should go into the nice green yes box.
Okay.
So basically you keep doing it until you go into the nice green yes box, then you've got it right.
Except it might determine that you don't know what your problem is.
Right, okay, but you know...
But knowing that is good.
The world, right, every problem in the world isn't that your network is misconfigured. But many problems are, so the first thing to do is rule that out. And if you rule that out, then I'm afraid you're down to more troubleshooting.
Okay.
But the point is, so basically, the entire 2 weeks have been leading up to that diagram for troubleshooting, because that's actually why it matters. And as a little test for yourself, if listeners want to test, see how well they've done, I don't know if you want to do this live on air, and maybe you don't.
You haven't even told me, and I think the answer is no.
Yeah. So basically, there are at the bottom of the show notes 6 little sample IP address and netmask combinations of two potential machines. And you want to figure out, are they on the same subnet? Yes or no? So you can figure out for yourself whether you think they are, and then click the little reveal button, and it will tell you whether or not they're the same and why.
Oh, this is a test?
This is a test.
Okay.
I've never done this before, but there's now a test in
your... I like this.
...taping the terminal.
Wait.
So do you want to do it then?
No, the test is just to try to... It's in your head, right?
Yes. Well, I was going to say, do you want to do it live on air and see if you're right?
Oh, geez. Okay. Let me think.
So you have an out.
I thought you meant test my network by messing it up. That's why I said no. Okay. So the first one is 192.168.0.1 and 255.255.255.0. Then the same IP address, but a different netmask. So if the netmask is not the same, they're not on the same subnet. No.
And in fact, if you see that, where the first bit's the same, but the subnet masks are different, you're almost certainly into a world of, oh my God, my routers are totally misconfigured. This is bad.
So the second one has the same subnet mask, but the third digit in the octet is different, and our quad
dotted quad.
Dotted quad is different, so I'm going to say also not on the same subnet.
Correct.
Yay! All right, the third one, let's see, subnet mask is the same. The IP addresses in the third quad is different, so I'm also going to say no.
Okay, but you didn't look very closely at those two subnet masks, did you? You looked at they were the same, but they're a Class B, not a Class C.
Oh, I didn't pay any attention to Class B and A. I only paid attention to Class C.
Right?
I have no idea.
So Class B, what that means is that the first two have to match, and the last two can wobble around. So actually, they're in the same subnet.
Oh,
because the first two are the same. They're about 192.168.
I thought I could ignore the B's and A's. All right, fine. So the next
one...
It's
not much of a test if I let you away with that, is it?
No, but now I didn't pay any attention to the stuff with the slashes in them either. I have no idea. So the next one he gives is 10.0.0.5/24, 10.0.0.124/24. I'm going to just say yes.
Okay, and the reason I put that example there is because /24 is the shortest possible way to have a Class C network. That is a Class C.
Just tells you it's 24-bit?
Yeah, 24-bit.
You told us 8, 16, and 24-bit when you said A, B, and C.
Yeah.
Okay, so I accidentally got it right, and I sort of... Okay, now you're doing hex. Go away, Bart.
Okay, but that's what OS 10 would tell you, right? If you look at your terminal commands, that's what OS 10 tells you. And the reason I put both of those in is because, again, it's a Class C in disguise.
Okay, he's got 0xFFFFF00, and that kind of looks like what I remember. And 24 is a Class C, so I'm going to say yes.
Well, no.
No, because the third digit in the octet's different, so the answer is no.
Okay, you got it right.
Okay, last question. Okay. Mm-hmm. 10.245.6.11, 10.245.7.11. Okay, those are different, but it says 16. And we had, must have been 8, 16, 20. It wasn't, I don't know what 16 is, but that's not the same as the zeros and the Fs and stuff. Oh,
it is actually.
I have no idea.
They're both class B.
Bart, there's no way on earth I would know that from what you've told me. I mean, I'm sure if I sat back and read the whole thing, I would, but no, I don't like that.
Yeah, but if you don't know, you drop it into the calculator website, remember?
Yeah, but I couldn't figure out where to put that 0xFFFF junk in the calculator, so.
It's the subnet mask. So you can stick it in there where you were putting your 255s. You can put that junk in there. It will interpret it.
I don't believe you.
You don't believe me? No, that's why it took bloody ages to write it. Well, it's really liberal on its interpretation.
Okay, fine. Hang on.
God, so if you take the second part of that, so 10.255.7.11.
Oh, wait a minute.
Okay, no, right. You can do it either way, right?
So you've got 10.245.6.11/16. You're telling me I can put 16 in for the subnet mask and it's
I am.
The net mask, it's going to work?
And you hit calculate, it'll work.
10.245. So I don't ever get to type in the X. The
well, you
F's
can copy paste those in if you like as well.
No, because I don't need them.
Okay.
Calculate.
And it will tell you all of the different ways you can write that same subnet. So you'll see that the F's are there. Let's work them out for you.
Okay, so you but it doesn't say anything about 7.11, so I got to put
okay,
that
so
one in.
7.11 into the test IP at the bottom.
7.11. Yes.
Yeah, that's the answer.
Okay. So I don't need to learn any of this. I just use your thing here.
Or yes, so the diagram will work most of the time. In fact, every example in that test would have worked with the diagram because the diagram has the Fs. So if you print out that diagram on your wall, it has all the Fs, so you would have gotten there too.
Okay, but I'm never going to look at anything other than a class C in my entire life. Not going to happen.
Until someday you're going to send me an email saying, oh my God, I found a class B.
In fact, I'm going to make mine. What's the smallest I can make? I'm going to do one of those 254 ones so I get that little t- or no.
254, you actually can't do. It's 252, I believe, is as small as you can go.
I want one with like six. No, I've got 17 things on my network. I got to have 18 then. Nobody else is allowed in my subnet.
I was going to say, you've got to be a little careful with that. You're going to plug in a new iPhone and it's going to go, oh, sorry.
That's okay. No, they don't work in my house anyway because I have to have an AT&T microcell. And if you're not connected to my microcell, you are not getting phone calls in my house anyway.
Well, your microcell needs to have an IP. I hope you're counting that in your 16 or 17 devices.
Oh, I hope so. It's whatever my router says I have. It says 17. So, well, you did bring us around, Bart. You want to pull in a conclusion here at the end?
Okay, so I may as well. So, bottom line, for your computer to work correctly, you must have correctly configured an IP address, a netmask, and the IP address of your router, known as a default root.
No, that's not a true statement. Your router needs to have done that for you.
Your computer needs to be configured with those settings.
Yes.
And how they arrive there
okay.
is arbitrary, but if it doesn't have those three, it cannot work. And when you're troubleshooting sharing problems, always start by checking that the subnets are the same. Because the chance, if they're not, all of these sharing things will be broken. And then if you find they are broken, well, at least you know why.
That's fabulous. That's a really good takeaway here.
So where we're going next, right, and we've hinted at it 20 billion times already today. So we have just sort of been taking it as given that DHCP does its magic. Yeah, we'll just say it's great. So the next time, we're actually going to decloak DHCP. It's not magic. It's actually a very sane and simple protocol. So let's look at it next time.
All right.
Watch it. It's magic.
We might need a non-head-spinning break here, Bart.
Well, believe it or not, the DHCP one is actually easy. Compared to this, right? Compared to this, everything's easy.
I hope so. You promise it's downhill for the rest of until we get to N?
No. Yeah, I don't know of a single other time. All right, I did a 4-year computer science degree. I'm pretty sure this was the peak in terms of making my head spin. Well, yeah, certainly in terms of terminal. Yeah, no, seriously, this is probably the last time I'm ever going to mention binary in this series.
Good.
No, I promise you, DHCP compared to this, a fifth of the amount of difficulty.
Okay. All right. Well, I noticed one exciting thing. If you guys go to the show notes, which you most certainly have if you've been trying to pay attention, is that if you go to make a comment, he has instituted the I Am Not a Robot reCAPTCHA from Google, so you may not have to do anything to submit a comment other than check a box.
Yeah. Well, when you say I implemented, I use a really cool plugin that takes all of Google's cool stuff and puts it into my blog.
Oh, I'll have to talk to you about that. By the way, session expires. I clicked it once and it gave me a little green check. Now it says session expires. Please verify again.
Well, so you may be a robot again.
Second time it gave me a CAPTCHA. That's interesting.
Because you've been suspicious. You timed it out. I was like, hang on a sec. What's going on here? Who's messing around with me for this long? If it gets suspicious, you get a CAPTCHA.
All right, Bart. I am going to go rest my brain and breakfast. So, because this was a tough one for me.
Okay. Well, hopefully the listeners, take two was hopefully more successful than take one. I was cranky with myself after take one. Anyway.
All right,
until next time, when there will be security light and all usual business will resume, happy computing.
All right. Well, we made it through. I'm glad you made it through to this end. I do want to remind you to buy Slough's song, If Every Day Were Christmas, in the iTunes store. It is so fantastic. Buy it for your friends. It's only $1. Best thing ever. I just love it. I'm actually going to buy it for some friends of mine, two of whom are actually in the chat room right now. You two people know who you are. Anyway, that's going to wind us up for this week. Many thanks to our sponsor for helping pay the bills, the makers of Clarify over at clarify-it.com and Hover for your domain hosting over at hover.com. Don't forget to send in your dumb questions, comments, and suggestions by emailing me at allison@podfeet.com. Follow me on Twitter and app.net at podfeet. Check out the No Silicast Google Plus community too. I'm telling you, it's one of my favorite resources. A lot of stuff going on in there. A lot of people helping each other, people helping me, people showing off. We even got a segment called No Silly Castaways Show Off, and people have a lot of fun kind of, you know, plugging the stuff they're doing they think is cool. If you want to join in the fun of the live show like Laura did for the first time and Ryerk, I'm not sure, we haven't actually heard from Ryerk, but she appears to be in the chat room. But anyway, Laura's been having a good time, and Sandy was welcoming her in there. But anyway, if you want to join in the fun of the live show, head on over to podfeet.com/live on Sunday nights at 5 p.m. Pacific time and join the friendly and enthusiastic No Silly Castaways. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.